Okay, do you want to make a podcast?
Yeah, let's
we'll give it a shot.
Yeah, it'll probably go okay.
Yeah, it'll go medium. Hey there, and welcome to episode number 164 of Marvel by the Month. 164, is that right? That seems excessive. Why would anyone need to do 164 episodes of this?
How?
I don't know. Anyway, we're an Eisner Award-nominated recommended podcast that takes you through the history of Marvel Comics one month at a time. In this episode, that month is September 1971. My name is Brian Stratton.
And mine is Rob Milne.
Now, normally, we would also have a Jamie Wenger here with us, but he is on vacation. We also have no guests this week either.
Yeah.
We have done some marathon recording sessions the last few weeks with some pretty huge guests lately. We had your Elliot Kalins, your Tom Brevoorts, your Werewolves by Night. I don't know about you. I'm just wore out.
Yeah, this is like extended, extended cuts of the entire Lord of the Rings is kind of what we just talked our way through. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. And I'm just going to level with everyone listening to this right now. This is a pretty low effort month of Marvel Comics. maybe not low effort, but it's not the most memorable month of Marvel Comics, and I think there's reasons for that.
Yeah.
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 Good reasons that have nothing to do with the level of skill or drive or desire of the creators.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's just a lot of books to put out, and this is one of those months.
Yeah. Yeah. And last month, they nearly doubled the size of all the books. They increased the price from 15 cents to 25 cents. And then this month, we're pretty much back to the original length that they were 2 months ago.
Yep.
But the price only came down to 20 cents because Martin Goodman. And so, I think you can kind of feel this. And this is something that Tom Brevoort touched on a little bit. Like, you've got creators who are being pulled in all sorts of directions where, they're being told, like, quick, everyone expand your stories from 19 pages to 33 pages. And so they start planning for 33 pages. And then, like, literally a month later, they're like, shrink them back down again. So they're like having to like cut and squish and, make these things fit into the size of the package.
Yeah. I think this is what, this month is what happens after you do that.
Yeah.
It's just like, okay, well, we got to take stories that should have longer arcs and try to mash them together into at least an act.
Right.
What it feels like.
Yeah. Because you've set up your cliffhanger to show up, like on page 32, but you've only got 19 pages now. So it's like, well, do you cut a bunch of stuff out of the middle? Do you just try to find a cliffhanger halfway through your story and build to that?
Like, yep. And that's exactly what we saw this month.
There's a few. I think the Spider-Man story stands out to me as one where it's like, guess this is our cliffhanger. Everyone's doing their best, but they're struggling to reformat things. They're stressed out. They're just trying to get through the month. So that's the energy we're coming in with.
We're recording this in our Marvel by the Month timeline right after a lot of bullets have flown into people and a lot of rights have been stricken from people.
Yeah.
So it's been a hell of a week. And here we are. And also for the people who are worried about, hearing too many of our opinions, just always jump forward about 5-10 minutes. You're going to be fine. It's going to mostly be about comics at that point, but find a different podcast. It's fine.
Yeah. I mean, you're going to trip over the opinions that we secretly hide, like squirrel away, in the recesses of our walkthroughs. There's like on the sort of the national and global front, there's all sorts of nonsense flying around. It's also like, woke up this morning. I woke up this morning, with a migraine, to my wife telling me that we had no hot water. So
just try to tread. Yeah. I did a self-care day. So I started therapy for the first time.
Congratulations.
In 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
I did acupuncture again after a few weeks off. And so I feel like I've been hit by a car, both mentally and physically, but it's for a good reason.
Yeah. So, we're holding it together, but, oh God, Jamie, please come home. We can't do this without you. Okay. You know what? We're going to soldier on just as the Marvel creators of September 1971 soldiered on and somehow put out a product. But before we fulfill the bare minimum of our premise, let's talk a little bit about what else was going on in the world of September 1971.
Yeah. On September 1st, 1971, a radio broadcast from Qatar announced the intention of the rulers of the Arab sheikdom to declare independence, with the announcement that Qatar was going to terminate special treaty relations and all agreements, engagements, and arrangements arising therefrom that were concluded with the British government.
I like the way that rolls off. Agreements, engagements, and arrangements. It's like Don King was writing their press releases.
Yeah, I also like therefrom. That's a pretty cool word.
That's a good one. You don't read that much anymore. Well, let's see. A couple days later, under the authorization of U.S. presidential advisor John Ehrlichman, a team of burglars who would later coordinate the Watergate burglary broke into the office of Dr. Lewis Fielding, a psychiatrist in Washington who was treating former U.S. Department of Defense employee Daniel Ellsberg, who had leaked the Pentagon Papers to the press earlier in the year. The burglars were able to locate Ellsberg's file, but were not able to find any useful information.
Oh, man. On the 4th of September, in an unusual and never explained incident, a large sack of flour literally dropped from the sky onto the baseball field at Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles during a game between the Los Angeles Dodgers and the Cincinnati Reds during the fifth inning. The sack was, quote, heavy enough to kill anyone it hit, and landed 10 feet in front of Cincinnati shortstop Woody Woodward. The Dodgers went on to win 2-1.
There you go. See, I knew if I tried hard enough, I could find a sports story you would care about.
Oh, I love that. It's so bizarre.
Speaking of bizarre, on the 6th of September 1971, the British Broadcasting Corporation announced that it was banning the U.S. educational children's TV program Sesame Street from broadcast in the U.K. because of the, quote, authoritarian aims of the show. Monica Sims, who sounds like a real fun person, the director of children's television programming on BBC, told reporters, educationalists in America have questioned the value of 2-, 3-, and 4-year-olds acquiring knowledge in a passive, uninvolved fashion and have criticized the program's essentially middle-class attitudes, its lack of reality, and its attempt to prepare children for school but not for life. I share some of these doubts and I'm particularly worried about the program's authoritarian aims.
What? What? Boy.
Yeah.
On the 9th of September, an uprising of prisoners broke out at the maximum security penitentiary at Attica, New York at 8:50 in the morning. A group of inmates on the 5 gallery on sublock A charged from the prison dining hall and overpowered guards who were attempting to stop them. Eventually, 42 members of the prison staff at the Attica Correctional Facility were taken hostage. After 4 days, 1,000 law enforcement officials stormed the facility on September 13th on orders from New York State Correction Commissioner Russell G. Oswald. 43 people were killed, including 9 hostages. The day after the retaking of Attica, the state of New York revealed that all 9 of the dead hostages had been killed by gunfire from the rescue team.
Whoops.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, on the same day, September 9th, what would become known as U.S. President Nixon's enemies list, prepared by White House public liaison Charles Colson, was sent in the form of attachments to a memorandum written by Colson to White House counsel John W. Dean, initially with 250 names on it. On June 26, 1973, Dean would reveal the existence of the list in testimony before the U.S. Senate Special Committee investigating the Watergate burglary. Do you know who else had a literal written enemies list? Wally Wood, who called it his shit list. He had it typed up and formatted. And here are some names on that list. Jerry Conway. Stanley Lieber, not Stan Lee, only referred to him as Stanley Lieber, Dan Adkins, Harlan Ellison. I mean,
yeah,
kind of goes to, yeah,
makes sense.
James Warren, who was the founder of Warren Publishing, who published Creepy and Eerie magazine, L. Feldstein, editor, writer, and artist for EC Comics and editor of Mad from 1956 to 1984, Keith Giffen, Marv Wolfman, and Joe Orlando. So, yeah, thanks to my friend and fellow Vermonter comics letterer Pat Brosso, who posted a photo of that list that made me aware of it.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Wally was carrying some kind of something on his shoulder.
Yeah.
Well, let's do a little Beatles by the month.
Hey!
On the 9th of September, 1971, the same day, Imagine, the second solo album by John Lennon, was released in the United States.
Yep, it counts.
And I'm going to tag on to my soon-to-be more important Metal by the Month notes. Deep Purple released their fifth album, Fireball, and Led Zeppelin was finishing up recording of a little number called Stairway to Heaven.
Oh, I've heard of that.
Mm-hmm.
I have been to a seventh grade dance. Probably not since I was in seventh grade.
That's good.
If there's anybody in law enforcement listening.
That's creepy, man.
September 10th, 1971, Time Life Incorporated and Sterling Communications were granted authority by the Federal Communications Commission to begin a pay television service for cable TV subscribers, which would be launched on November 8th, 1972, as Home Box Office.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm.
On the 11th, Nikita Khrushchev, 77, de facto leader of the Soviet Union from 1953 until he was deposed in 1964, died of a heart attack in Moscow. The Soviet government acknowledged Khrushchev's death 2 days later with a small obituary in Pravda, an announcement by the TASS agency, the TASS.
Yeah. And then on the 15th of September, at least 15 people were killed and 57 injured in an explosion at a French-owned South Vietnamese nightclub in Saigon. While South Vietnamese police blamed the Viet Cong for setting the bomb, some local business owners said that the bomb had been placed by South Vietnamese soldiers who were extorting protection money from the nightclub.
Ugh.
So that whole scene's going great.
Yeah. On the 21st of September, David Philip Vedder, the American hospital patient who became known as the Bubble Boy because his severe combined immunodeficiency syndrome prevented him from risking exposure to the outside world, was born in Houston, Texas. And I, you know, feel a special kinship for the Bubble Boy.
I was going to say, I put that in there for you because I thought, you know, that was maybe a hero of yours.
Yeah. Yeah. Just want that cosmonaut suit in a 6 foot six, you know, somehow.
And yeah.
Just live in that.
Yeah. On the 25th of September, Hugo Black, Associate Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court since 1937, died 8 days after announcing his retirement from the court at the age of 85.
On the 30th, the agreement on measures to reduce the risk of nuclear war was signed in Washington by U.S. Secretary of State William P. Rogers and Soviet Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko, with the two nations agreeing to notify each other immediately in the event of an accidental, unauthorized, or unexplained incident that could increase the risk of nuclear war. In addition to the agreement on averting nuclear war, Rogers and Gromyko also signed an agreement to modernize the Moscow-Washington hotline by adding two additional circuits connected to a satellite communication system and teletype terminals to supplement the existing telephone.
Yeah.
Those are those red phones, right?
Yeah, yeah. Because you really don't want to get a busy signal on that thing if you need to no. get a message through.
Have it cut out partway.
Yeah. And then finally, on September 30th, the same day, the Washington Senators baseball team played their last game in D.C. before their move to the Dallas-Fort Worth area to become the Texas Rangers. Thousands of fans entered the grounds without paying, the security guards having left early, swelling the paid attendance of 14,460 to a paid and unpaid attendance of 25,000. With the Senators leading 7-5 and two outs in the top of the ninth inning, several hundred fans raided the field for souvenirs. One man stole first base, like literally stole first base. And umpire crew chief Jim Honochick declared the game a 9-0 forfeit to the New York Yankees. Because the Yankees are the worst.
Yeah.
So that's a glimpse of what was going on in the world of September of 1971. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk about what was happening in the Marvel Comics of September 1971 right here on Marvel by the Month.
Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Let's talk about Fantastic Four number 117, The Flame and the Quest, written by Archie Goodwin, art by John Buscema and Joe Sinnott. So we're going to be totally honest with you. There's not really any issues this month that were real standouts, except maybe for Avengers, and we're saving that for a special episode that you'll hear in a few weeks.
Yeah.
And we already talked about Marvel Spotlight number 2 last week, so we're just going to talk a little bit about each of the other 8 stories that came out this month, and we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, yeah. This is, again, low effort record.
Yeah. So in The Flame and the Quest, Johnny starts off this story by being Johnny and getting really mad about how he misses Crystal. She needed to leave the polluted air of the USA before it killed her.
Yeah.
Basically the polluted air of any developed country, because she's used to the refuge.
Right. And this, so this was this at the very beginning of that crazy like 15 issue run that Tom Brevoort was walking us through?
Yeah.
All this stuff happened like within the space of like two or three days.
The whole Overmind story.
Yeah.
All within maybe a day.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody ever went to bed. It was just like nonstop things happening.
Right. Yeah. And before that was like the Negative Zone thing with, you know, Kirby's last issue that got chopped and screwed and all that. And so it's like, if you barely remember Crystal having to like leave public places on Earth to go back to the refuge, that's like, I totally get it. Cause that came out like a year and a half ago,
right,
in like newsstand time. But for Johnny, that was like 2 days ago.
Right.
So
right.
For once, it's actually plausible that he might still be upset about something.
Right. Right. It seemed after reading all of those events, like Johnny had forgotten about Crystal and then got mad about it again.
Right.
But when you realize that they all happened back to back and nobody ever took a bathroom break, this is this is where we're at.
Yeah.
So Crystal left with Lockjaw to teleport back to the Great Refuge. That was when we last saw her.
Right.
So Johnny goes and tries to find her there, and he tries to terrorize some more Inhumans like Jeez. He likes.
Yeah.
But this time they are being ruled by Maximus, so they attack him instead.
Which, I mean, good.
Yeah.
Like, what was this guy thinking? Like, last time he showed up there, he, like, tried to burn it to the ground.
Yeah.
Like, think they're going to roll out the red carpet for you, dude?
He's going to be public enemy number one. It doesn't matter who's leading. So Johnny leaves because, you know, he's attacked severely by a number of Inhumans. And he heads to Agatha Harkness to try and find some arcane help in locating Chris.
Mm-hmm.
Sure enough, Agatha uses a crystal ball.
Oh, I see.
To locate Crystal.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess tell some backstory because I don't exactly understand how the events work here. But we learn that the greatest Marvel supervillain of all time, Diablo.
Oh, right.
Just kidding. Diablo was sent to a wasteland Earth in the future by the actual greatest Marvel supervillain of all time, Doctor Doom.
Right. I remember that. It was like in a one-off. Marvel supervillain team up or something like that.
But yeah.
It was the first solo Doctor Doom story where he was like the protagonist of the story.
And then he banishes a villain, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
To a wasteland Earth, like post-apocalyptic. And that happens to be where Crystal and Lockjaw apparently accidentally teleport to across. I don't know that we have ever heard of Lockjaw teleporting through time, but he did. Here we are.
And it happened, Crystal says, when Johnny flamed on just as we were teleporting, it must have frightened you. Instead of a short hop to the Great Refuge, you brought us into the this. Yeah.
So immediately, or pretty quickly, Diablo gasses them both, knocks them out to buy himself some time to concoct a mind control drug for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. And then he gets, once he's got them under control, he gets Lockjaw to teleport the whole gang through space and time,
right,
to see the good old communist like dictatorship of Terra Verde.
Because it's a Latin American country. So of course they're having a revolution, because that's the only reason that you have a Latin American country in a Marvel comic of this era.
And this one's always having a revolution.
Yeah.
and then another one. And so it's the normalish president of 1971. And I'm guessing this is sort of revealed through the crystal ball too. Diablo makes the populace and Crystal believe that she is Ishul, which exactly translate to goddess, by using her elemental powers to move rocks and make rain and such. The reigning dictator thinks it is all malarkey and sends some troops who encounter a revolution in the works because she's convinced them, that convinced the people. So, of course he sends fighter jets, which seems like overkill to bomb the peasant uprising. And they do. Like, that was there is a little bit more, obvious death in the comics of 1971.
Yeah.
And all of this is happening. The junior member of the FF is arriving on the scene in Terra Verde. And he sees the jets, but thinks it's like a maneuver that the army is doing and decides to not get involved, which would right when they're possibly bombing Crystal.
Yes.
And that's where this issue took us. And I have a feeling that it was another whole issue worth of story.
Yes.
That got cut to the next issue.
Yeah, so, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. This, the final page, page 20, is a splash page with a giant image of Johnny flying in the foreground and the jets in the background. And there's, you know, a nice landscape, but it really does have the feel of something that was just like, okay, this is the cliffhanger.
Right.
You know,
chapter one done. Yeah.
Yep. So, so there we go. That's what's going on, in Fantastic Four. We're following up on the Crystal story, which is great. I do also want to note that, Archie Goodwin does seem to make slightly more of an effort to include a little bit more Spanish than we usually see when we are, you know, seeing like a Latin American country. So I'm going to give him credit for that. It's still, you know, a little of the time.
Yeah, it's slightly better than Speedy Gonzalez levels of Spanish.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So, well, I'm going to talk about another Marvel hero who winds up traveling far away from the city that he's normally found in. This is The Amazing Spider-Man, number 103. The story is called Walk the Savage Land, and it is written by Roy Thomas. The art is by Gil Kane and Frank Giacoya. You know, like we mentioned at the top of the episode, this is a 20-cent issue. It does have 24 pages of story, so the closest they could come to a cliffhanger, which I think is kind of a funny cliffhanger, apparently happened on page 24 of what they were going to go with.
Yeah.
Here's what happens. First thing we find out is the Daily Bugle is headed for bankruptcy. Cause it turns out they can't compete with TV news. And Jonah's getting all upset, but he realizes they can get ideas from TV news about how to beat them. And there's a fellow named Richard Culkin who is being interviewed by Dick Cavett about being attacked by some sort of monster in Antarctica a few weeks ago. So Jonah immediately puts two and two together. He determines that the monster must have come from the Savage Land because he met Kazar in Amazing Spider-Man number 57 and hired him to hunt Spider-Man.
Yeah, like in a hotel lobby or something.
Yes. Jonah decides that despite the fact that his newspaper is incredibly cash-strapped, that he and Culkin and Peter Parker are going to fly to the Savage Land and get pictures of the monster. So, I mean, my impression is that getting to the Antarctic now is not a easy thing to do.
Yeah.
This is like 50 years ago.
Expensive trip.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Very expensive.
Yes. Not to mention the fact that, you know, it's not like there's, you know, direct flights to the Savage Land. It's like you can get to Antarctica, but then you got to find the Savage Land. So
I love how he also makes Robbie call Peter to tell him he's got to do this job. And if Robbie doesn't do it, won't call Peter.
Yeah.
Jonah threatens to fire him.
Yes.
It's a classic Jonah.
Classic Jonah. And it's not just going to be the three of them going. They're also going to take Gwen Stacy along.
Yeah. That's the other. I think Peter's coming in to insist because he's getting close to proposing.
Yes.
And then Jonah's gets the idea that it would be real nice to have a nice looking young lady with them for photos.
Yeah. So he kind of pitches it as that Gwen can represent the women's angle. Mm-hmm. And also he's like, and you know, no guy ever was upset at, you know, having a good looking girl in the paper or whatever. Mm-hmm. It turns out like as soon as they land in the Savage Land, he has her stripped down to a bikini and pose for photos that Peter is just like only too excited to take.
Yeah. Like, and we've already seen like we know what the Savage Land is like.
Yeah.
We've already seen a pteranodon or a pterodactyl. I really don't know the difference. And some, you know, I feel like Elliot Kalin's going to hit me in the face about this at some point.
Yeah, he's already writing a sternly worded tweet. Yeah,
but right as they're coming in, to, you know, through this dense cloud layer to get into the Savage Land.
Yeah.
And, so, you know, this place is dangerous. This is like Australia on meth.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. But no, they just as soon as they land and she, you know, slips into the bikini, like all the blood just goes straight to their boners and they can't think straight. Yeah. So, yeah.
It's so weird to think. Yeah.
How, yeah.
Jonah's so excited about having the pictures to sell in the newspaper.
Yes.
Everything just feels terrible.
Oh, and he has a crazed expression on his face, too. Yeah. It's gross. I'm just gonna, it's gross. Also, I still don't know how Jonah expects to make more from selling papers than this whole thing is going to cost.
Right.
Like, I just don't get it. But, you know, I'm not a newspaperman. Anyway, so they travel to the Savage Land. Jonah finds a huge gong and rings it.
giant snake monster dinosaur statue behind it.
Yeah, so it's totally fine and safe. You know, first it summons a tribe of native people, and then it summons the monstrous Gog, which is a classic Kirby style giant monster, who I have to just point out is wearing more clothes than Gwen is at this point.
Yeah. And he's like a I'm trying to think of the best way to describe him. You know, he's got a tail. He sort of stands like a man with a tail.
Yeah.
But his face. He's
sort of got like an abomination face.
Yeah, that's really close to it. And yeah, he looks like another He-Man action figure.
Exactly.
To me.
Yeah. I mean, he's orange, but and it makes sense that his face would look sort of abomination-y because Gil Kane created the abomination. So
my favorite thing is that he's yelling what can best be described by today's standards as like a decodable, it's not decodable, it's just random alien scream, like characters that you see him saying and there's no way to know what it is.
It's like Simlish, like,
yeah,
go in there.
We just don't see that very often, you know, where there's a depiction of a different language at this stage,
right? Yeah And that it's specifically meant to be unknowable, and clearly. So Gog shows up, swats Peter, who falls off a cliff, which makes everyone assume that he's dead. And this frees him up to go into action as Spider-Man, as long as no one sees him, or they'll quickly put two and two together about his true identity. And look, I mean, I know the book is called Spider-Man. I know he had to put the duds on at some point, but it's like, if that was his concern, he could have just like not dressed up as Spider-Man, right?
Right, yeah.
Anyway, just, you know,
that is the most improbable thing since he was in London,
right?
When Peter Parker was in London, Spider-Man shows up.
Yeah, exactly. I do think Robbie would have figured it out at this point. Like if he put two and two together with Peter in London, like, you know, it's like if it happens again in the Savage Land, like it's going to be very difficult to come up with a convincing story. Yeah. He's not a dummy.
Spider-Man's either Gwen or Peter.
And depending on the reality you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that the person who is behind Gog's rampage, he's Gog did not take it into its own head to do all these things. Turns out Kraven is the mastermind behind all of this. He ordered Gog to go grab Gwen so she could become his jungle queen or whatever. Because, again, we're doing a jungle adventure story, so the girl has to be, you know, the jungle queen character.
And Kraven has to show up because this is where his pants belong.
Exactly. Yeah.
And his lion face vest.
Yep. And frankly, the facial hair. So Jonah and company run into Kazar and Zabu, who, of course, Jonah, you know, remembers. Spidey winds up finding a giant snake, and then he winds up catapulting himself straight into quicksand. And that's our cliffhanger. Yes. Which, again, it's like you can absolutely tell, like, that was not meant to carry the burden of this entire issue and get the kids to pick up the next issue.
Yeah. You got a guy who can shoot webs who fell into quicksand.
Yeah. It's like he'll probably get out pretty easy.
You have to write a lot of word balloons to make it seem like there's any danger whatsoever.
Yes, exactly. But again, jungle adventure story. Of course, quicksand's going to show up at some point because it's the greatest threat to our health.
Oh, man. It's just nonsense. That's all it is.
Yeah. My only quibble with the story, other than the fact that it is total nonsense, not enough Kazar in it.
Yeah. Well, we can remedy that.
Okay.
Astonishing Tales number 9 is what I'll talk about next. The Legend of the Lizard Men. It's written by Stan Lee, allegedly. Art by John Buscema. There's one original story and this month's Astonishing Tales and 2 reprints that we're not going to cover. So, also, this is not a continuation of the Kazar story from Astonishing Tales number 8.
Because there was a cliffhanger. I'm trying to remember how the last one ended. Like the World War One was being refought with like flying dinosaurs.
Yeah. We had, it might've been two. It was one.
World War One or two. Yeah. And so there was a cliffhanger. I don't clearly remember it right now, but that's not the story that we're going to tell right now.
Yeah.
This is a story that I believe chronologically takes place before the previous issue.
Yeah. So John Buscema really wanted to be the artist on Conan, but his rate was too high, so Marvel gave it to Barry, not yet Windsor Smith, instead, and it turned out to be a pretty good decision.
Yeah, yeah. It worked out. I mean, you know, Big John did get his crack at Conan. At Conan later.
Yeah.
When they were starting it out, it was an unproven property. Martin Goodman was not willing to open up the pocketbook because he was also paying $200 an issue to the Robert E. Howard estate so that he could do a Conan comic book. $200.
That's taking too much of the cream for that guy. Yeah, man. I wonder how much somebody got, what the page rate was at that point to draw this.
Oh,
thing.
I know. Yeah. But it was like, I mean, it was the license cost considerably less what the artist cost.
Yeah. 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 So this 16 page Kazar story, you can see Big John basically auditioning for Conan.
Yeah.
It's got a bare chested warrior protagonist, a sexy sorceress, some lizard people, and it's all very Robert E. Howard.
Mm-hmm.
Comics chronologer Super Mega Monkey thinks this was an inventory story, meaning there was a Kazar story in the Savage Tales black and white magazine that only lasted one issue, and that was by Stan Lee and John Buscema. So he says, I suspect that the story was originally intended for Savage Tales number 2, and when that series got canceled, the story got put here. So this story is also the same length as the story in Savage Tales number 1. So that's pretty good. Also, the fact that Stan Lee wrote it means it must have been sitting around.
Yep, exactly. Because Stan he's taken several months off at this point. So, and this is the only thing that has his byline on it this month.
Yeah,
so.
And you can tell also that there are fewer footnotes about why a character is, say, appearing in 2 places at one time.
Yep.
Things like that. Mm-hmm. Or that they are appearing in 2 places at one time. So, yeah, the story begins with Kazar encountering this very sexy sorceress named Iranda or Iranda, who Zabu is instantly enamored of.
Yeah.
Kazar seems pretty taken with her as well, maybe because she feeds him, maybe because she's not wearing a shirt.
Yeah. and that also kind of goes along with the idea that this might have been a Savage Tales story because that was a more mature rated magazine.
Right.
So, I mean, obviously she's got hair down to like past her back. So,
yeah.
Like, I mean, there's, you know, it's still very kid friendly, but she's clearly not wearing anything above her waist.
Right.
Yeah.
As she's moving about off panel, we know that Kazar is getting some views.
Yes.
So now, you know, they both seem stricken with her. He tells her he's looking for a tribe of lizard men who carried off all of the women of a nearby village when the men folk were out hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And Irand is like, oh yeah, I know those guys. They work for me. Kazar goes to attack them as they appear. But Iranda says that's all of her lizard men are used for purely defensive purposes. So
it's like, yeah, I have lizard men, but I mean, what
my lizard men wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
You know?
The old man was mistaken. The lizard men are not to blame. And Kazar says, how can you know this? And she says, because they serve Iranda. And then she goes on to say, my lizard men live only to serve and protect me. The sightless one was old. His senses did betray him. But then she says, but one thing puzzles Iranda. Why did the hunters not return to their plundered village? So that's the other core mystery, is like, what happened to all the women who were stolen? And why do those hunters never come back?
Yeah. And man, to mistake a bunch of lizard men somehow, that seems like even a blind-ish older man, it's probably not gonna make that mistake.
Probably not.
It's probably not a football team or anything. So they, you know, Kazar is kind of buying it. So they head out together to Iranda's castle. And Kazar risks his life to save one of the lizard men when a stone bridge collapses.
Mm-hmm.
They arrive at the castle and Iranda orders a feast in Kazar's honor. So more food. Yep. But the jig is up when he recognizes one of Iranda's servants as a missing woman from the village.
Mm-hmm.
Cue a big fight during which Kazar steals Iranda's crown, the source of her power. The lizard men pursue him to get it back before moonrise for some reason.
Yeah. This all feels, I mean, this really does feel like a Conan story.
It's totally a Conan story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even the way her hair is drawn, like the way that the shadows are used in it all look like they fit.
It looks really, like really classic, like a Hal Foster, like that era of, you know, the golden age of newspaper strip illustration,
sword and sorcery. It's just so it's very solid art though. It's beautiful.
Oh, I love it. Yeah.
So now the big fight has happened. The lizard men pursue, Kazar to get that crown back because moonrise is apparently some kind of deadline.
Yep.
Kazar doubles back to Iranda's castle to learn her secret. He stumbles into a trap with flaming gaps in the castle floor. He fights a bunch of lizard men again until the moon rises and Iranda's illusion of beauty drops. She's a lizard lady. Yep. Kazar ducks as she lunges at him and lands in the fire.
Yep.
And she burns to a crisp and honestly probably smells pretty delicious. You know, long pig. But I'm a pescatarian, but roast lizard gets me every time. As soon as she dies, all of the lizard men turn back into the missing men from the village because they were enchanted, you see.
It's
very simple.
Yep.
And while everyone celebrates their victory, Kazar plays lip service to the comics code by mourning for tragic Iranda.
It's totally a Conan story, with the serial number filed off.
And it's one of the most cohesive stories of this month. Because it's just a Stan Lee thing laying in there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a story they had done. It was designed to be this long.
Yeah.
And it was also meant to be one and done, you know? So, and the fact, if it was going to be appearing in the next issue of Savage Tales, like, it makes sense that it would sort of have that Conan vibe to it because that was the lead feature in the first issue. So it's basically it's like, how can we do a second Conan story without having to pay the license fee again? You know, you do it with Kazar. You make your Tarzan knockoff a little bit more Conan.
And that works. You just throw some magic into the Savage Land and bam.
Yeah. We'll talk about throwing some magic around. Let's jump over to Daredevil number 82. This is one of the few stories that takes place in New York that are talking about this month. This one is called Now Send the Scorpion. It's written by Jerry Conway with art by Gene Colan and Jack Abel. I hope you're not tired of the Mr. Klein storyline, because we get some exciting new developments this issue.
We've already revealed who he is. Nobody cares. Come on.
Oh, but he's not done crafting his web of intrigue. So issue begins with Daredevil-ing around Manhattan without his trusty billy club, which doesn't seem like a great idea.
Talking to himself nonstop.
Oh my God, does he
just
ever.
Just telling it his own name, Foggy's name, doesn't matter. He's just outside somebody's window yelling all about his job.
Mm-hmm. it's just babbling constantly. And I'm trying to remember what, like, he lost his billy club last issue or recently or something.
Yeah, I can't remember why. Maybe when he went underwater after the owl attack.
Oh, yeah, that sounds right.
So then the Black Widow rescued him.
But not his billy club. Thanks a lot.
What's weird is that if you look at him in this first splash page, you can see the little
the holster.
You could see the holster, or possibly what is just drawn as the club tucked into where it always is.
Yeah,
as he's talking about not having it.
Yeah.
So I don't know, that seemed weird. Unless those are like different martial arts weapons than the billy club. I don't know, I don't remember.
Yeah, I mean, I think the editorial and production was totally overwhelmed this month.
Just wing it. Yeah, and the whole thing, this whole scene just ends with him almost missing a ledge and almost falling to his death.
Yeah, he like manages to snag a ledge while he continues berating himself in the second person.
Yeah, yelling out his actual identity all the time.
Yeah, wild. Okay, it's so, I mean, obviously, like, this is like Jerry Conway is... he's trying to give Daredevil a unique voice and quality, you know, because this all started when Jerry took over the book. So he's like, I guess we're just going to have Daredevil be the guy who's constantly talking to himself, you know, and it's like, it does sort of distinguish him a little bit from Spider-Man. But I don't know.
It's not a lot at this point.
Yeah, not a lot more, though. You know, it's, I mean, it is a different kind of patter, I guess, but
it's not quite as, it's not the same kind of neuroses. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a different flavor.
Yeah. It's strange with these solo heroes, like, because, you know, in the first few pages, they're trying to get you up to speed on, here's all the plot threads that you need to be aware of. And if you don't have someone for them to be talking to, it's either a bunch of thought balloons or they're just shouting out loud to themselves. So, yeah.
But I still think thought balloons would be a good way to go when you're talking about all of your friends and your secret identity. That's just my opinion.
Yeah,
a little
discipline. Yep.
The heroes don't stand by that code. They like to talk about all of their personal life while they're standing in an alley next to somebody's house.
You know, then again, Daredevil, even at this point and certainly into the future, I think of all the superheroes, probably has the most trouble maintaining a secret identity. I feel like he's getting outed left and right,
right,
and people are discovering it.
Well, he's really bad at covering it too, because then he just ends up in four different costumes at once. And then we get fat garbage Thor.
Fat garbage Thor. Never forget. Okay, so elsewhere, Black Widow is, she's brooding, and her brooding is interrupted by an urgent call from her chauffeur, Ivan. He barely manages to warn her to beware the sting before the call ends. And that doesn't make any sense, because Steve Borden doesn't make his in-ring debut until like 1985. So I'm not sure what he's getting at.
Maybe
here.
He's talking, no, that's still too early for the police.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Did you know, that Gordon Sumner has to pay Steve Borden for the right to bill himself as Sting in the United States?
No.
Because the wrestler got the trademark on it in the U.S. before he did.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I don't know. That made my eye twitch in a fun way.
Yeah. There's a really funny photo of the two of them from the 80s where, like, Sting the wrestler has Sting the singer in a headlock.
I need to see that when we finish this.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Okay. Well, back to this comic. We get a gratuitous shot of the Black Widow getting dressed, as we do in every single Black Widow story now.
Black Widow's here. She's going to get dressed.
Yep. And then she heads out to find Ivan. And it turns out that Ivan's assailant is the Scorpion, who KOs Black Widow with his dumb stumpy tail. And that's, I was thinking about this also, like the Scorpion tail, the fact that it's like rounded and blunt, that has to be a concession of the comics code,
I'm
right?
Sure, because it's dumb.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just super dumb.
It just, yeah, it's the wildest thing.
And it looks dumb. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It just looks really silly. he does not look dangerous.
He looks psychotic, but yeah.
Sure. Yeah, exactly.
So that kind of dangerous. Just right. Like that. Don't go by the guy with the weird stumpy tail costume.
Yeah, yeah. But he looks like a sock monkey.
Yeah.
Yeah, a green sock monkey. okay. Meanwhile, Karen Page is falling for her agent, Phil, or maybe she's just using him to forget about Matt Murdock.
Mm-hmm.
And speaking of Matt, it turns out he's got a full-on machine shop in the basement of his townhouse, which he's using to make a new and improved Billy Club. That would be suspicious, right? If anyone ever saw the fact that this blind lawyer has a machine shop in his...
Yeah. It seems like it. He even, as he's constantly talking to himself, he says, aside from being a first-class monologist, you're a top-notch engineer. Of course, who'd hire a sightless mechanic? I mean, this is just a couple word balloons of the constant yeah. talking to himself. It is really kind of weird.
Yeah. Also, I like the fact that Jerry Conway has doubled down on, it's not just that like every doctor or professor in the Marvel Universe is a doctor or professor of everything, but now like anyone who's good at anything is good at everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lawyer, martial artist, engineer.
Yep.
Actually physical engineering, probably some hypothetical stuff.
Yep.
He might be a physicist. I don't know.
I mean, if he needed to be.
Yeah. Just say so and bam.
I'm just going to throw this out there. I have read ahead a few months in Daredevil, and he does land. It's either a space shuttle or a plane at some point in the near future.
Oh, so. I love that in the early days when he would just like jump in a car and drive it off a dock or something. We're like, don't drive a car. I don't. But a plane especially. Like,
yeah.
He did fly a plane or semi-crash a plane once already.
Right.
Or a helicopter.
Or a space shuttle or yeah. something. Yeah, I don't know.
Or no, a rocket.
He landed a rocket in Central Park. Yeah.
That was a fun one. I think Noah was on for that.
He's good at everything.
Deconstruct that.
Yeah. Noah also is good at everything.
That's true.
Daredevil, he's got his new improved Billy Club. I don't quite understand what's improved about it.
Nope. I thought they might expand on that, but instead he just talks to himself for the whole time and clicks a button.
Yeah. Gene's in a little bit of a hurry this month. we're not going to judge. Murdoch hears a thud from upstairs. He goes to investigate and finds Ivan unconscious with a note addressed to Daredevil challenging him to save the Black Widow's life. So of course he daredevils on over there and he gets thumped by the Scorpion's still stupid stumpy tail. they fight and fight and fight. And then the Scorpion just kind of stares off into space and runs away.
I loved that. That was my favorite part, that he just fights until Daredevil's thrown into some vines or something. And then he just sort of blankly stares off.
Yep.
It was a nice touch.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Foggy Nelson, who's being blackmailed by Mr. Klein, drives to his home with the intention of shooting him instead of paying him $100,000 blackmail, which he does not have, or letting his terrible secret from 2 years ago come out. So whatever the secret is, has got to be, I mean, the fact that Foggy, who is a good person, is contemplating cold-blooded murder.
Yeah.
It's
got to be huge.
Oh, it's going to be earth-shattering.
Yeah.
When we finally learn about it.
This is going to be a Pizzagate thing.
Yep. But Mr. Klein reveals himself as the robot MK9, which we knew from previous issue. He disarms Foggy. And then he chortles that Foggy did exactly what he predicted he'd do. And now Foggy is an agent of the Assassin.
Because that's the slightly cooler name than MK9.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yep. Then finally, Daredevil tracks Scorpion to a construction site where he's holding Black Widow. Scorpion is fussing with a broken transmitter. He's panicking that there's no one to tell him what to do. Daredevil and Black Widow team up to beat the Scorpion and accidentally knock him off of the unfinished tower.
I love that. Dude.
Where he falls to his death.
Yeah. He's yelling, "I follow the assassin. Against him, none will dare prevail. I follow death."
That's a great last word.
just fall off a building.
Yep. So Scorpion's dead. And the Widow is left wondering, did I do that? because, you know, she's convinced of the jinx. So that's a good chunk of issues. Let's go ahead and take a quick break. And then when we come back, we'll talk about more of the Marvel Comics of September 1971, mm-hmm. right here on Marvel by the Month.
All right, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Let's talk about Captain America and the Falcon, number 144.
This is the last one we have to talk about, right?
This is it. This okay. is it. We've made it. This is the last one. And I think it's the best one.
I'm going to say so, yeah.
Yeah. So this one's called Hydra Overall. It's written by Gary Friedrich, art by John Romita. This issue is basically two totally separate stories. So I'll do the first one, and Brian, you can run us through the second one.
Okay, fair deal.
We open on a splash page of a Hydra meeting where they're burning an American flag and chanting their slogans. A caption says that Hydra is the deadliest of all threats to democracy and world peace, which just feels kind of quaint now.
Yeah, I sort of miss. I miss the days when, you know, like the most existential threat that we had to face was running around and, you know, green pajamas with a giant yellow H on his chest.
Oh, it's a little guy. I want to just give him a noogie.
Yeah.
Little Hydra. So suddenly Captain America and Nick Fury and the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. fly in through the windows on jetpacks and start beating up the Hydra goons.
It's so much fun. Yeah.
The threat is over.
And Fury is like so nonchalant through the entire thing. He's just like relighting his cigar. Like,
people are kind of coming at him and he's just, I can't get this stogie lit.
Yeah.
After a few pages of this, we see Richard Nixon and the senior members of the Department of Defense are watching the battle on a monitor. He tells Nick Fury that they can halt the exercises now, but Fury has one more thing to show him. Oh, boy. Fem Force One.
Which I keep wanting to call Fox Force Five.
Yep. definitely where it came from.
Yeah.
This is led by Agent 13, Sharon Carter, and they're a team of female S.H.I.E.L.D. agents who are out to prove that they're just as capable as the boys.
Yes, and they're all, it's a multi-ethnic group of women agents.
Yeah.
And she's like, they didn't leave us much to work with, but we got to show that we're just as good as the men folk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because it's 1971 and this was a thing that was still very open to debate.
Yeah, exactly.
So S.H.I.E.L.D. makes short work of the Hydra goons and Nick Fury presses Nixon for funding.
Yeah.
He especially wants funding for more life model decoys, maybe because they just blew up several dozen that were pretending to be Hydra agents. We're going to need to replace all the things we did so that we could get the money.
Couldn't you just have not done the exercise?
It's such a funny thing.
Yeah.
Nixon pushes back and says that the decision is not something they can make a snap decision on. And once Nixon hangs up, Fury grumbles about the administration spending a fortune in Vietnam, but slow walking his funding.
Yeah. You get the feeling like this is the part of the issue that Gary Friedrich was really interested in writing.
Yep.
Was
yeah.
like all the debates about funding defense and things like that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
He's obviously making a pretty solid point in a really weird way.
But, yes.
But Fury shakes it off and sends Cap and Sharon on a vacation, which Cap says they'll go on just as soon as he gets a good night's sleep.
Well, let's talk about that good night's sleep.
Yeah.
In part two, which is titled The Falcon Fights Alone. So this one is still written by Gary Friedrich, but the art is by Gray Morrow. I think the only Marvel work we've seen from him was the first appearance of Man-Thing. But he did a lot of work for Warren Publishing for Creepy and Eerie, and a lot of other stuff.
Yeah, also. A much more artistic, illustrative style. Yeah.
Very much so. Yep. Yeah. Anyway, so much for Cap's good night of sleep, because we see him on the splash page that opens this, tossing and turning through a nightmare of the recent racial unrest in Harlem that he just went through, I think, in the previous issue when it turned out that the Red Skull was a black radical, or pretending to be a black radical.
Yeah. That would be a better way to put it.
Yes,
for sure.
Yes. where, yeah, once again, you know, folks who had legitimate grievances and were, you know, militant activists were just being
misled
by, and you know, taken advantage of by a supervillain.
By a Nazi supervillain.
Nazi supervillain. But that's not the only thing Cap is bothered by. He seems especially bothered by the fact that his partner, Sam Wilson, the Falcon, is falling for a militant black activist named Leela Taylor, which we have seen kind of building over the last several issues. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I'm 99% sure she's basically like just a very thinly veiled reference to professor and activist Angela Davis. I mean, she resembles her, like hairstyle and clothing and everything else, like pretty one for one. Mm-hmm. Davis had just been in the news. She had recently been arrested for purchasing guns that were used by the Soledad brothers to seize control of a courtroom in Marin County, in California, which resulted in the deaths of the three prisoners and a judge who they had taken hostage. So that's who this character is based on. She wasn't involved in that, but she, you know,
she helped
her,
it.
Her
she
name
helped.
Was on the receipts.
Yeah.
So Leela has been giving Sam a hard time about turning his back on his people by working with Captain America, who, you know, to be fair, is about as Caucasian as you can get.
Yeah.
And Cap is spying on them through the window as they argue. And also Sam is trying to put the moves on her and she's having none of it. It's kind of a weird scene. Like, if you just look at the body language and don't read the captions, and then you read the word balloons also.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Yeah. There's something a little off about it.
Yeah. It feels like it's trying to do a will they, won't they, of course.
Yeah.
Which is what it's trying to do.
Yes.
But it looks wrong for that. And yes. Even the language, it seems wrong for that. It seems like, just, it went a little further in the previous issue, and now it seems like they're walking back their spark.
Yes.
And she's not really into all of the kinds of groping and touching that Sam's trying to pull.
Yeah. There's also like an implication that there's sort of like a quid pro quo going on here.
Yeah.
Which also is not cool.
Yep. There's not a lot that's cool about the whole thing, including Cap spying.
Yeah. And as soon as Leela leaves, Cap comes in through Sam's office window and apologizes for being unintentionally insulting last issue. But that is too little too late for Sam. His conversation with Leela clearly is still on his mind. And he gives Cap a piece of his mind.
Yeah.
Also, he's stripping off his clothes while he's talking to him.
Yeah, which is another part of that weird homoerotic thing.
Yeah.
Not weird. It's like a pretty obvious thing at this point. Like,
yes.
You could put different word balloons on any Captain America and the Falcon story at this point,
yeah.
And it all feels like they are having a romance.
It's not even subtext at this point. It's like you look at the opening splash page, and it's a person tossing and turning, having a bad night of sleep, while he's thinking about two people in love, or you know, like starting a relationship,
like his partner and somebody else. Like there's just so much about it.
And he's saying, I see them. He's with her again.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, this, the visual vocabulary of this issue is a romance comic.
Yeah. It's a gay romance comic.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
And I know that probably makes some people mad and makes some people happy, but it looks like that the last issue, even more so. It was all about each of these two partners being upset about their relationship with their lady friends.
Yes.
And even the writing is such a way that just it's hard to not feel that subtext. It's so weird.
Yeah.
It's so weird to think of it now, like that probably wasn't intended, but it just comes across so strongly.
That's the thing I wonder, because like Grant Morrow didn't do a ton of work for Marvel, and the comics work that he tended to do was more countercultural and more, you know, sort of mature readers. So it's like, I wonder if he's making a point here. Like, I mean, yeah. I wonder if this is like, he's like, well, let's just make the subtext text.
Yeah. And Gary Friedrich's, you know, kind of touching on it, but mm-hmm. He's trying to make his points like about racism.
Yeah.
And, you know, as Sam's giving a piece of his mind, he's saying like, that's the trouble with you whites. You think you've got all the answers when you don't even ask the right questions.
Yep.
On the day you realize that, then maybe you'll have the right to say, you know how it is.
Yeah.
And Cap is like, okay, I guess I deserve that. All whites deserve it. And just to see that that's in a comic book from 1971 was a real weird thing to see, realize Captain America is saying that he's representing that.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's what Gary Friedrich's putting over the top of this too. Yeah. So there's lots of it's not the best comic in the world, but it's exciting to see these ideas being brought forth.
Yeah. I mean, they're not hitting all the notes exactly. I don't know. They're not hitting everything perfectly, but they're taking big swings. And when they're missing by a mile.
Yeah. But not by a Roy Thomas mile, but by a mile.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, they're missing, but they're at least kind of missing in an interesting direction.
Yeah. You know? That's where
not an insulting direction.
That's what I think is like they're posing this as a conversation that could really happen between these people.
Yes.
Like, it doesn't feel like Stan doing an over preachy thing. It doesn't feel like Roy sort of missing it entirely or making sort of the opposite point on accident,
yes.
You know,
yeah.
In his early work. Again, you know, there's lots of work that these guys all have done. It's just that there have been some bad missteps there.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, there's a very good reason that the Falcon is taking off all his clothes while he's talking to Captain America. He just wants to show off his new costume.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yep.
There's no subtext.
Yeah. Him throwing his boots and stuff out in front of Cap as he's sitting on a floor looking interested or sitting in a chair. He's just like, he looks like he's like, ooh, literally looks like he is going, ooh, as he sees these clothes fly out of this doorway.
Yeah. It's,
weird. I mean, it's weird because that's not what you think is supposed to be happening with these characters, but it seems like that's what's happening.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to read it in any other way. It's one of those things when you first see it, it's hard to unsee it. And then it's hard not to look for it in like every interaction with these characters.
That's the other problem.
So anyway, the Falcon now has his, you know, a costume, but more similar to the costume that I think we all know him in.
Yeah.
The red and white.
This is a cool, I mean, it's very 70s. I mean, he looks like he's going to
plunging V.
Yeah. The plunging V, like he's going to be doing some show with Kiss. He's got the sort of luchador kind of mask at this point, like not all the over his whole face, but it's wrapping around his head. And it's white and red.
It's hero colors.
Yeah. And he's got one glove. You know,
yes, the Falconer glove.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which I loved that touch.
Yes,
and that still has his like Falcon grapple on it.
Yep.
So, yeah,
yeah. And his boots have little Falcon feet.
Other than the flying V and exactly how tight and weird it is, it's a pretty cool costume.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. Like, it really does feel like a Lucha costume. Like,
yeah,
it feels like he had this made up in East Harlem, and like he's very happy with how it turned out.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, everything about it is that, and in the best way for that context.
Yep.
But it's kind of weird, but I think it's better than his old costume.
Yep. And so Sam, he's got new duds, he's a new man, and he just tells Cap he's not going to be his partner anymore, and they part amicably. You know, Cap doesn't push. He's just like, well,
he pushes. He's like, I guess I'll have to agree, but isn't there some way we can continue to? And Sam cuts him off.
Yep.
He's trying to keep their relationship strong.
Yeah. And Cap has no bandwidth. He has no opportunity to push further because a young man bursts through the door to tell the Falcon that some pushers have got a friend of his hung up real bad, which I don't know exactly what that means.
Me
but
neither.
Got him hung up real bad. Cap immediately leaps into action, but Falcon steps in. He's like, I will handle it by myself. And again, Cap, to his credit, he's like, of course I overstepped. I'm sorry.
Yep. And Falcon's kind of doing, this is my turf too. You know, this is where these are the people I live with.
Yep. Exactly.
Back off.
So we cut to the two, white pushers standing over a black user, who is going through serious withdrawal. And they're planning on shooting him so that he doesn't tell the cops about him. I guess it doesn't have to make sense because they're drug dealers. Boo.
Yeah.
You know, so,
it's like, did they give him an overdose? Like, couldn't, when the hung up, I was trying to figure that out, but then they're just threatening to shoot him.
Yeah.
Just normal old school shooting.
Yep. So. But Falcon, he bursts through the door. He makes short work of them. And then as he exits the tenement, the Falcon is cheered by the locals who hoist him up on their shoulders. And Cap, of course, is still spying on Sam
way in the background of the
from
scene.
The rooftops. And he heads home and tries to get that good night's sleep that he promised his girlfriend he was going to get so they could enjoy going on vacation together. But all he can think about is how much it hurts to lose Sam as his partner and how he'll never let that happen to him again.
I love how that was maybe supposed to be a dream, you know, it's like presented as like maybe he's just dreaming this entire thing, but then it's like, no, that really happened. Now I'm back in bed again. It's cool.
I don't know. I found it really a fascinating story. I wish there was more information out there. I was trying to see if I could dig up like any interviews or anything online or, you know, any additional information on this, but like, it really does feel like a bromance comic. Like,
yeah. We got to talk. Maybe Joe Keating knows some more about Grey Morrow too.
Yeah,
I don't
know,
but, there's something about it. And with all the other nonsense we've read, we just walked you all through.
Yeah.
Dear listeners, the Gary Friedrich is just starting to stand out more and more as a good writer, or as a writer who can do something with substance, sort of like maybe not as coherently as Archie Goodwin yet, but he's got something to it that makes the comic, you know, more worth reading and just not nonsense happening.
Yeah, totally. I mean, these characters did feel more like human beings than like, I think, any of the other stories that we read this month.
Yeah. And also we're back in New York, you know?
Yeah. Yep. New York City. We're back in Fun City.
Yep.
Okay. Well, hey, we did it. We made it through all of the Marvel Comics of September 1971. I'm very proud of us.
And they all made it through with us. Everybody out there, thank you.
Yes. And now the only thing to do is just share our astonishing takes, which is our recommendations for things that our listeners might want to check out that are not the Marvel Comics of September 1971. My recommendation this month is for a book that I'm reading called American Comic Book Chronicles, the 1970s, by Jason Sachs and Keith Dallas. It's published by Tomorrows. So I'm about 80 pages into this so far, and I'm really, really enjoying it.
Yeah, I've done about 15 pages of that same book.
It's really thorough and it's well researched. It's also extremely readable. So like, I really like Tomorrows as a publisher, because I think they, better than anyone, they do a really great job of kind of preserving comics history. But I mean, you know, they do tend to be sort of like, a lot of the stuff is written by, it comes out of the fan community, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like the quality of the writing can sometimes be somewhat uneven. Mm-hmm. That is not the case here. So, I mean, if you like what we do, you're going to almost certainly enjoy this thing. And they also have the advantage of only covering the extreme highs and lows. They don't have to cover the majority of, you know, stuff that's like, it's competent, but unremarkable. You know?
Like say this week.
This entire month of comics. So it does a really good job of providing context for what was happening broadly across the entire American comics industry. And there's a different volume for most decades. And like finding this kind of stuff, especially finding it all in one place, you know, so that you're reading about several topics, but like chronologically.
Yeah, and coherently.
And coherently. Yeah. It's very hard to find, honestly. Like, you can find interviews here and there. You can find, you know, people who do a deep dive on like all of Kirby's stuff, or, you know, a specific artist or writer. But to find all of it in one place and just kind of get that over that broad overview is rare. And I really appreciate it. So I know that this stuff from this book is going to make it into my research. So I wanted to get ahead of that, make sure that I'm giving credit where credit is due.
That's so awesome. Yeah. What I've read so far. And the thing that interrupted me from continuing reading it was Douglas Wolk's All of the Marbles.
Yep.
So All of the Marbles was just another version of that. But I find, you know, if you're a listener, we definitely sound, especially thanks to Brian, very well researched. And most of my, you know, credit is just that I've read a kabillion comics. But I do now. I'm so interested. I follow all these Facebook channels of Gene Colan appreciation and Jack Kirby. And
yeah.
I mean, these weird groups where I had to answer specific questions to get into them.
Are you a cop? You have to tell us.
And I, you know, watch interviews with Kirby, and I'm just fascinated by these creators now. Yeah. And I think that you can tell as we're talking about it, but this bug has bit us, as it's bit many of the creators of comics that we talk to as well. The stories of these people making this is just fascinating.
And so many times the stories behind the scenes are more interesting than anything that makes it onto the page.
Yeah. As Tom Brevoort and Mark Evanier have said, it's high drama in a normal mundane setting of people doing a job.
Yep.
You know, mine is a little more of a fun piece. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, I have a tendency to talk about Judge Dredd. This one's called Judge Dredd Blaze of Glory. This, I got this one because it's a collection of a lot of Al Ewing stories. Nice. For Judge Dredd. There's art by a lot of artists, including Simon Fraser, John Higgins, and Liam Sharp. It's put out by 2000 AD. It's just a fun collection, showcasing like a big swath of Ewing's Dredd stories.
Nice.
And it crosses all of the hallmarks of a good Dredd story: the dangers of fascism, the absurdity and horrors of what the near future holds, life in Mega City One, heists, mutants, and even an attempt to kill Santa Claus. it also has a nice little, there's an ongoing joke in Mega City One Dredd stories. All the blocks, the big giant buildings where people live, mm-hmm. All have names that kind of reference often political or other piece, just like celebrities of the day. So right. When you go back and read the stories, you catch more and more of that if you know more. And one of them, I was so pleased during, there's a Sex Olympics story in which people have to, you know, perform sex and get judged by, and in the actual Olympics, mm-hmm. and when they're in the Dan Savage block, and I was so awesome. I don't know, I assume he knows that he has made it into the mega city.
That's so good.
But I was so happy to hear it. I love Dan Savage.
Judge Savage. Well, that's all we got for you this week. Thanks for listening, and if you want to maybe help us continue to make this show every week, consider subscribing to our Patreon for the fantastic price of $4 a month at patreon.com/marvelbythemonth and get exclusive content. You can also review us on Apple Podcasts or whatever you're using to listen to us. If you'd like some free stuff in the mail, send us a screenshot of your 5-star review to marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. Find us on Instagram at @MarvelByTheMonth, and MarvelByTheMonth.com has links to our other social channels as well as our shop. Yeah,
I want to also say, you know, buying some of our merch is another way we get some money.
Absolutely. So, yeah.
You know, that's another way to support. Patreon's probably the more beneficial for you since you get to listen to longer episodes. But, you know, if you like the swag, get anything. Get a shirt, get a mug, get a, I don't know, a, you can get a duvet cover.
Maybe you want a t-shirt with Iron Man's gauntlet thrown up the horns that says death to false believers on it. We have that for you. Yeah. So, I mean, that's it for now. So until next week, my name is Brian Stratton.
And I'm Rob Milne.
And we'll see you next week for next month. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, and stay inside and read comics.